The following is David Bloxham, Donna LaShaw, Eduardo Ortiz, Eric Gibb, and Aviva Rosenstein's talk, Designing for Villains, from the 2014 Information Architecture Summit.
The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. Stay tuned after the podcast for more information about All You Can Learn.
What would Sleeping Beauty be without Maleficent? Luke Skywalker would just be a whining teenager without his dear old dad, Darth Vader. Your oatmeal would be a cloying bowl of slop without a dash of salt. Villains are the key to any good story. They provide the conflict, the struggle, and the hardships for our hero to overcome. We're not actually talking about those kinds of villains today. We're talking about marginalized users. These users are a little different. They have unique goals and needs. They're probably not going to be cast as a small business owner valiantly struggling in a GoDaddy commercial, though. Our esteemed panelists today have designed for these marginalized users. But I'm going to back up again and call them villains. These villains who refuse to use the designs that we've made for them, that we've thought out, our elegant, beautiful designs, they use them in ways that we never intended, those bastards. That sounds familiar. Each of us has a story to tell, and then we'd like to talk with you. Panelists, please introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon. My name is David Bloxham, and I've worked for Naked Sword, a gay porn streaming website, for the past 11 years.
Information architecture,
with a strong emphasis in design, project management, and production.
Hi, I'm Donna LaShaw. I've been working in tech, starting out in CD-ROMs, DVD-ROMs, and onto web and mobile for about 15 years now. And I'm a teacher, help people do stuff.
Good morning. My name is Eduardo Ortiz. I'm a designer. A Marine, a shit starter. I've been working in the industry for a little bit over 10 years. Currently working for the Consumer Protection Bureau, designing products to help the American public make better financial decisions and prevent another financial markets meltdown.
Hi, my name is Aviva Rosenstein. Currently, I'm working in enterprise UX for the most part. I've been studying how consumers use technology and people use technology for 20 years, five in academia, and the last 15 in industry. I have the word insight or research in them somewhere, but I see myself as someone who helps designers and developers understand their users.
And I'm Eric Gibb. I'm currently a designer for Tangible User Experience in San Francisco. I spent 2 years as the director of user experience for kink.com, the largest kink, fetish, and BDSM pornography producer in the world. That's where I picked up my Twitter handle,
One-Handed GUI.
I didn't really get many innovative ideas while I was there.
Not about design.
But, like the other folks up here, I took a few things away from me that have served me well.
I'll give you two of those lessons that I learned.
One is that my villains were not stupid. They're just very, very focused. Like your dad walking around the room, he's got his glasses on top of his head going, "Where are my glasses?" They're really, really focused. They've got their credit card in one hand and their mouse in the other hand. And they can't find your buy button. You can't make your call to action big enough. You need to get everything out of the way, including your own ego, to help them be successful. And the second thing that I learned is that they are not ashamed of what they're doing. They just don't want to talk to you. They may or may not know why they're doing what they're doing.
They may not want to be able to articulate what they're doing to you.
So you have to try to talk to them in their own language.
You have to make it safe.
You have to give them a place where there's no shame, and they might bare their souls for you. And when they do that, you've got magic. David's villain is a sweater gay, attracted by a slick, brightly lit storefront, but rapidly and gleefully finds himself cavorting in filthy, forbidden alleyways.
I can't think of a more personal experience than porn. Porn tastes vary not only from person to person, but also from day to day. Something that turns you on today might bore the hell out of you tomorrow. So the first thing I had to learn when I started working at Naked Sword was that I had to take my own personal preferences and tastes completely out of the equation. This wasn't about me. This was about the people who are coming to my site and what they were looking for and what they were hoping to find. Like any other project, I had to start focusing on those people. And just like any other project that we would do, the techniques and the tools that I would be using to accomplish that project would be exactly the same, no matter how kinky or exotic the content. About a year ago, we did a redesign of our site, and this allowed me a really good opportunity to kind of revisit some of the taxonomies and the themes and categories we were using to maybe improve them and make a better experience. My first step was to familiarize myself with the content, which meant surveying every video we had, which was not a small task.
Based on the types of content we had,
what I expected us to add in the future, I created a list of descriptors for that content. Types of content: bondage, twink, foreign, water sports, etc. I then went and researched existing taxonomies, both in my industry and in mainstream video, because there is a lot of overlap. We're selling video, it's the same product with a slight twist. That really helped me get an expectation for what people coming to the site would be expecting, so that our terms would kind of match what other people were using. It also inspired a lot of debate. We debated over whether we would use the term foreign or international, or maybe each of the countries would have their own category. I also had to consider legal concerns, so our payment processor was not going to let us use terms like barely legal or raped and tortured, which is a category, P.S.
Then there were marketing concerns.
Basically, anything that has bareback attached to it is a huge success. To add to this complexity, the meaning of a term can be different for different people. To some people, fetish means fuzzy handcuffs and dirty bed talk. Ooh, daddy. For others, fetish is full suspension, latex outfits, and electrical toys. For most of you, a bear is a dog-like carnivore who enjoys picnic baskets in Jellystone Park. But to some people, a bear is a subgroup of the gay community that rebelled against this perfect Ken doll male figure and embraced a rounder, fuller, hairier gentleman. To add complexity to that discussion, that term bear has evolved over time and has been embraced to cover basically any man who has body hair now. To help address this issue, I developed a controlled vocabulary based on the descriptors I developed for the content. For example, orgy means four or more people in a scene. You think you wouldn't have to define that, but another factor we had to consider was the visual content. We're not only selling words, we're selling box covers. And we found that we had a problem where our users were going to our black theme page and they were seeing box covers that had white models on them. And they were getting confused. What was happening was, is our encoding department, who does all of that tagging, was basically, if there was a black model in the movie, they were putting it into the black theme. And so what I had to do was create an interracial theme and said, use that for that. And black means there has to be a majority, at least 75%. So that way, the box covers would visually reflect the themes that we were using too. By using those themes and keywords consistently and paying attention to the visual representation of the content, we were able to help ensure that our users knew how to find what they were looking for, even if our terms didn't always match the terms that they thought they should be. The next step was building a simple, clear structure. Our target audience, the one thing that we have that's really advantageous for us is that we can usually be pretty sure that our target audience has his pants around his ankles, one hand around his erect penis, and the other on the mouse. Because of this, the architecture needed to be simple, and it needed to have the least amount of clicks to the money shot. One obvious sorting scheme is to sort by studio. Studios have built-in marketing. People, a lot of times, are going to look for a specific studio, and most studios develop the same kinds of content. So, for example, a title from Bijou Films is probably going to have 60s or 70s gay vintage porn with bad editing and a crappy soundtrack. I also use the descriptors as another way of sorting. So going by the principle that simpler was better, I made really broad, high-level categories. And I kind of use those based on what our customers were watching. And I also use Google Analytics to look and see what search terms were people were bringing in. Recently, we had feedback from our customers that we don't have enough content. And I was actually kind of pissed off when I saw that, because I know that we have over 4,000 titles that span just about every kind of legal genre fetish you could imagine. But when I put myself aside, I realized that I think the broad categories probably aren't doing a good job of surfacing specific content that people are looking for. So one of the things I've been working on is trying to make that more granular. I probably won't go to the Netflix level because I don't think that categories like 20-somethings with excessive bangs who suck lollipops and pout while having sex is going to be a big draw. And yes, we have that type of porn on the site. There's actually a real connection between twinks and lollipops for some reason. And twink is another good example of domain-specific terms.
Monitoring what types of
monitoring what customers are searching for, and more importantly, what they're watching, helps us to adjust our marketing to attract new customers. It helps us surface popular content while suppressing less popular content, reducing visual clutter. And it helps us to determine what types of content we should be producing ourselves. Despite all of our tools and techniques, we need to remember that designing experience is almost never a one-size-fits-all adventure. We're designing for human beings who are quirky and kinky and even downright strange, at least from our perspective. Definitions change and evolve over time. One person's bear is another person's overweight slob. Creating the best experience is an ongoing process that requires you to understand the people who are using it. There's no shortcut or magic bullet. It takes some research, some empathy, and unlike most sex acts, it requires you to remove yourself from the process.
Donna's villain is a bit harder to pin down. Perhaps a well-read 20-something hipster who wants to tell his friends he's browsing suicide girls for the intellectual stimulation.
Thank you. So, I'm going to tell you a story about a time when I couldn't empathize with our users, nor could I empathize with the business,
nor did I have the tools, might be the trick there.
It was a very long time ago, 2000s, the dot-com bubble had just burst, and I moved to New York City, I'm from there, and I finally, after working very hard, got my first New York City web design job, which was very, very exciting. I was going to be working for an online magazine, Holdouts of the dot-com era that was actually still around, which was even more exciting. And we prided ourselves on producing what we called literary smut. And so, in other words, it was a website for people who liked literature, who read Norman Mailer, maybe Dave Eggers, and also liked looking at smutty pictures and reading smutty stories as well. Now, it wasn't something that I was completely into.
I liked reading books.
Smut was something, okay, I could absolutely get behind. And so I was really excited to start this job, start to get into some new territory, meet some new people, get to know our users, and I show up on day one, and I'm told, yes, we're still calling ourselves literary smut, but we're actually turning into a lad mag. Now, for those of you who don't know, a lad mag is the magazine that's for dudes who like cars, chicks, and gadgets, things like that, Maxim or FHM, monthly monthly magazine, and it was no longer going to be for men who liked smut. It was really just for the dude market. And it was not what I signed up for, but also this posed a few different problems for me. So, you know, I was college educated, I understood about feminist space. Something that I had studied for many years was architected spaces and gendered spaces. And so, for example, a building, usually domestic spaces, are crafted around women and women's work and what we think women should do. Same thing with digital spaces. We craft spaces that are gendered often when we assume that a certain gender needs to use it for certain things. Now, did I want to craft spaces for dudes who wanted to gawk at chicks? Not really. And so, I had to figure out what to do with this. Another problem with this was that in crafting these spaces, a lot of what my job was now entailing was Photoshopping. I had to do things like crop images a lot, so do what basically is disembodying women, chopping them up for male consumption. Now, what this helps you do is the male gaze when women's bodies are chopped up is optimized because you don't have things like women's eyes staring you down and intimidating you. So I got to do a lot of cropping, and I got to do a lot of airbrushing of nipples, pubic hair, and tan lines, all things that were signifiers of very bad parts of women's bodies. So in other words, if you airbrush a nipple out of a photograph that you crop, women's boobs are huge, and it's exciting. And same thing with tan lines, really, really long torsos, and you know, these women looking amazing. And so, you know, I was very unhappy with the things. And so, I did what any good college graduate would do. I tracked down my favorite professor, a feminist film professor from undergrad. And I asked her, what do I do about this? I would say you have to quit. This is not for you, you're perpetuating the system, and you know, don't do it. And she looked at me and she says, basically, RuPaul's legs. Now, at the time, I was kind of baffled. I didn't know what that meant, RuPaul's legs. And she tells me, basically, if I'm going to be chopping up these images, no one needs to know where the legs came from. And, you know, maybe I can insert a couple of, you know, shots of RuPaul's legs next time we have a cover story and, you know, and see what happens. And it worked for the next year. I spent much time on the internet, finding lots of shots of RuPaul's legs, using them when I could. I found shots of, if we had a story about a romantic straight couple, I would often find images of queer people, two men, two women, they might be kissing, embracing, off in the distance. You couldn't tell what their genders were, and it didn't matter. No one found out. For me, what I found was, we talk about all these tools that we now have. Again, this was early in my career. I didn't have these tools to build empathy. I didn't understand about understanding the business and why we were moving towards this model. And I had the one tool I had, which was subversion. And it ended up being really fun. And so, you know, in hindsight, I always ask myself, who was the villain in this case? Was it me? Was it the business? Was it the users? And it might be all of the above. And sometimes that's okay. When you can walk away, it's wonderful. When you can't walk away, subversion is a great tool to use. And I hope you all use it wisely when you can in the future. Thank you.
Eduardo's epic tale has twists and turns in which the heroes are villains and the villains are actually the heroes.
Contrary to popular belief, I will not be doing a can-can demonstration with this cane.
So let's start with a non-controversial definition
that we are all super fond of. How about we define the difference between information architect and UX designer? Just kidding, we'll leave that for Twitter. Let me give you a definition of a word that we'll come back to and that is core to my story. Sankey Panky. S-A-N-K-Y-P-A-N-K-Y. A Sankey Panky is a sex worker, usually found in the Caribbean and the Dominican Republic. A Sankey Panky usually solicits everywhere, online, in the beaches primarily, and has clients of both sexes. They're sex workers. Okay, story time. There was a time in my life where I was gung-ho, young, and quite dumb. Obviously, I'm no longer young. In the early 2000s, a friend asked me to go into business with him. He offered great pay, and he told me I had the freedom to design whatever I wanted. If this sounds too good to be true, it's because it was, but I was obviously too dumb to notice. On my third day, at this apartment slash office, I finally figured out that I was going to be working for a company that was a sex tourism portal on the third day. I was going to be designing a portal
that allowed tourists, primarily Europeans, to visit
the Dominican Republic, book their travel, their lodging, and also book companions. And while I was somewhat stunned by it, I decided to stick it out because the pay was really good. And I think I had just turned 18, and let's face it, the pay was really good. I was invincible. Well, it turns out that I have three sisters. I was raised by my mom, my nana, and my grandma. And things weren't looking that good. Once I started
looking into things.
But again, I decided to stick it out. A few days later, my friend says, let me give you a tour of the rest of the apartment. This is like about a weekend. I finally decided to look at the rest of the office. And he decides to show me the studio 18-year-old Eduardo is like, those are some pretty awesome cameras. Look at those lights and those tripods. What are those for? Oh, well, you see, we're going to be shooting some amateur porn to show the visitors what they're going to be experiencing in their companions. Still completely way over my head. I wasn't getting it. I figured that this wasn't the vision that I wanted to back, and that I wanted to
do something different.
I told him that this wasn't cool with me, and we started to have a few conversations to see how we could change the product. And this is how it went down and what I learned from it. First, I learned that I needed to talk to anyone that was impacted by my work. I learned to communicate. I proceeded to interview our models and learn about them.
By talking to them?
I was completely blown away by their life stories. I learned that a lot of them were doing this to pay their way through school. A few of them were doing this to be able to put food in front of their kids. And that a few of them were doing this because they needed to help their families. And like, they were doing this out of free will. That was not something that had even entered my realm of knowledge at that point. Had I not spoken to them, I never would have figured it out. And while I didn't quite understand what I was doing or why I was doing it, talking to these women made it clear that I was impacting their lives and that I had the ability to do way more than I was doing, and that it was up to me as a designer to either do it or not. Second, I learned to listen, act on what I listened to, and I learned to care. I learned to have empathy. Something that became obvious as I listened to this woman was that while I didn't want to be doing it because I had women in my family, I wasn't really listening to them. I wasn't really caring. And once I started to detach my notions of what was right and wrong, I started to be able to actually understand where they were coming from and to try to see what they saw, try to understand what they felt. Obviously, I couldn't put myself in their shoes. I wasn't good looking enough, but I tried my best to
understand
them. To put them at the forefront of what I was working on. Third, I learned to stand up for what I believed in. I learned not to be afraid. After listening to their stories, I started working on trying to change the product. I started working to try to drive the traffic from sex tourism to some sort of dating portal, because this woman had been hacking the portal since its existence. They were not just hooking up with this tourist. They were actually establishing relationships. So I said, why not? Let's focus on this. This is a legit market. Well, it turns out that the market for sex tourism is a heck of a lot stronger than the market for a dating site.
Hey.
18-year-old Eduardo had no clue what it meant to do things, but it's fine. I still don't.
I finally realized
that it was just not going to work out, and I decided to walk out. I voiced my opinion, my friend shut me down, and I walked out. While I no longer had a high-paying job, I could no longer afford expensive meals at restaurants 3 times a day, 7 days a week. And I could no longer go back to spending all weekends in a beach town surfing, and now I was going to have to just watch TV.
I felt that I had regained my soul.
I felt that it made me a better person to have walked out, and a happier one. At least I think it did. And the one lesson that I took away from it is that the bottom line is that as a designer, each and every one of us holds the keys to making the world a better place. As long as we're willing to make the changes that we want to see, we believe in ourselves, and we never give up, there's nothing that we can't achieve. Thank you.
Aviva's villains are a contrast to those typical guys in suits we all make fun of, and scary people with a Bible in one hand and their gun in another.
I'm not going to talk about the porn industry, sorry.
I think everybody in this room probably understands
that empathy for the user is at the core of the user design process. And we've heard some great stories so far on designing for users and in some cases for bosses who may be hard to empathize with.
So as the last panelist, I'd like to share
three lessons that I've learned that may help you about how to proceed when you're faced with designing something for people that you don't like very much or maybe just don't want to be around. So here goes. Number one, question your judgments. Everything that you believe may not be true just because you believe it.
At the beginning of a project,
to write down what you believe. Write it down somewhere and set it aside. Don't let it touch your data, just set it aside. For example, if I asked you right now to imagine the characteristics of a salesperson, everybody have that in their head?
You would probably
be likely to come up with some negative stereotypes, like
shallow,
greedy, competitive, maybe pushy. And I had those too when I started working
at Salesforce, but I spent a few years working
with teams that were building enterprise software, both for salespeople and the people that manage salespeople.
And the thing is, nobody is a villain
in their own story. And the salespeople were no exception.
It turns out that some salespeople really think
that they are providing a valuable service to people who may need what they have to offer. And just like us, just like designers, they're interested in understanding their customer needs so they can tailor some kind of solution to fit it.
When I started working in enterprise UX, my employers had just figured out how much value sales teams
would get out of sharing customer information across the sales team and collaborating with each other on deals.
So at the time, they were investing very heavily
in tools to support collaboration. If Salesforce had built their personas for salespeople
just around the negative
personality characteristics that people come up with when they think of them, they would have missed this huge market opportunity.
Our brains like easy answers.
It's very hard not to fall into making the fundamental attribution error. That's the one where we tend to blame other people's behavior on something innate about their personality or their characteristics
as opposed to
their environment. But you can't blame the behavior of a group entirely on their negative personality attributes or their lack of moral compass. It's true some salespeople may be motivated largely by their compensation, and some can be pretty aggressive about making their numbers, but the social situation of a sales organization is really grounded often in competition. In some workplaces, salespeople are not collaborating at all.
They're only incented towards closing.
They're responsible for their quota or their toast. They're out the door. If they're not the top producer, then they don't get the bonus.
They're required to be greedy bastards
most of the time. So I had to start out by admitting that I didn't know everything, and then I had to verify those beliefs with data.
If you do that, then you won't be making bad decisions about your designs
based on your false assumptions. Okay, number two, and I'm expecting some pushback on this, which is fine. When you go out to design for people that you don't like very much, be a blank screen. When you interact with users face to face, you have to strive to make your self-presentation unremarkable. Now, here's the thing. User researchers and designers often have very limited access,
if they have access at all,
to connecting with their users and their customers.
You don't have much time.
And you need to make the best use of the time that you have, and you have to develop trust really quickly. Otherwise, they won't be honest with you about their experiences. But nearly everybody that you interact with is going to be making quick judgments about you based on appearances. We're stereotyping them. They're stereotyping us. I know that kind of sucks, but that's just how brains seem to work. So our informants need to be able to project themselves onto us in order to establish some trust. And keeping your self-presentation bland enough to do that during interviews and site visits is really critical. If they can stereotype you as other because of your self-presentation, your hairstyle, or your tattoos, or your clothes, even the way that you speak, they may think that you won't be a sympathetic listener, and they'll be less likely to confide in you. Or they might get distracted from your interview questions and start asking you questions about your ink or your purple hair, which is a waste of your time. Or they might get distracted by your cleavage and try and hit on you, which again is a waste of your time. If you can't be like them, consider how you can at least make yourself appear non-remarkable. It helps keep the informant's focus on their experience and not on you. And if you can't do that, consider going remote and keeping your webcam off. Finally, number three, avoid your triggers. If there's something that you can't get past, then get out. I'm a cancer survivor, and I almost never talk about this. I had endometrial cancer, and I beat it, but my fertility was a casualty. And since I hadn't gotten around to having kids before I got sick, it was really hard to get over that loss and that grief when I recovered. About a year after I was well enough to go back to work, my employers informed me at the time that their new content strategy, their new market strategy, was reaching pregnant women, Bible belters, and outdoor sportsmen. And they wanted me to conduct ethnographic interviews with those target groups. Now, I realize that pregnant ladies and Second Amendment supporters and Southern Baptists are probably not most people's idea of villains. But at the time, I would start to lose it anytime people talked about their kids. And I should also mention that, I was raised Jewish. And B, I'm in favor of gun control. So the idea of doing primary research with these groups was terrifying. A name like mine, Aviva Rosenstein, it might as well be Jewy Jew McJewerstein. It might have been a bit of an obstacle to building quick rapport with Bible belters. It's a clear marker of not being around from there. And part of my head was afraid of being accused of killing their God and getting lynched. You know, it sounds dumb, but it's in my head, it was some combination of the Klan and deliverance. And frankly, I would just not have been able to cope with interviewing pregnant women at that point in my life. Nobody wants the interviewer to start sobbing uncontrollably during an interview. Now, fortunately, the execs switched their focus from pregnant ladies and Bible belters to the relatively unthreatening discount shopper demographic.
So I dodged those bullets.
And once I actually got into the field, I really enjoyed interviewing the hunting and fishing folks.
I learned a ton about deer processing
and fishing licenses and how hard it is to coordinate guides and licenses and plan a trip. You know, the thing is, as long as we're willing to set our biases aside and gain the informant's trust, once we get in the session and really start to listen to their stories, you really will be able to take their perspective or at least develop some empathy for their needs. But my real takeaway from that experience is better for both you and the project to stay the hell away from your emotional minefields. If you honestly can't be neutral in a particular situation or with a particular group of people, or you think you just will not be able to manage your emotional reactions, just get out. Consider finding a colleague who can spot you or maybe outsource it to a vendor to handle instead. The thing is, we have to take care of ourselves when we need to. We're human and we have feelings, and sometimes we just can't deal. And we need to cut ourselves slack from time to time. Thanks for your attention.
So Aviva's story is about self-management and self-control. It was inward-facing in service of being user-centric. Eduardo's story has an activist bent, taking something over and attempting to rechannel it into a more positive, progressive direction. Donna's story celebrates a subversive approach. If you can't beat the program, I'm sorry, if you can't beat them. David's take is also user-centric, self-erasing, almost zen. Maybe villains aren't villains. Maybe they are. So Aviva's story is about self-management and self-control. It was inward-facing in service of being user-centric. Eduardo's story has an activist bent, taking something over and attempting to rechannel it into a more positive, progressive direction. Donna's story celebrates a subversive approach. If you can't beat the program, I'm sorry, if you can't beat David's take is also user-centric, self-erasing, almost zen. Maybe villains aren't villains. Maybe they are. A man looking to get off might be the same as a woman trying to win a hand at poker, might be the same as a salesperson hunting whales, might be the same as a parent trying to find a healthy recipe for homemade baby food. They have needs. We help them solve in the most appropriate way and hopefully make a little money along the way.
If you can't empathize with them,
if you can't put yourself in their heads without feeling bad about them or yourselves, you have to get out. Thank you.